It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Over the last week, the USDA confirmed cases of a highly pathogenic avian flu in Texas, Idaho, Michigan, New Mexico, and Kansas among cows. They also confirmed at least one case of human transmission in Texas found in a person exposed to infected dairy cattle. While the strain of avian flu has been very dangerous to birds, so far it doesn't look as dangerous for cows or for people. Our next guest is an expert on human and animal infectious diseases. We're taking a look at the latest on this virus and efforts to prevent it from spreading. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in agriculture yourself? Have you encountered avian flu in a poultry, maybe poultry you've worked with? Are you worried or do you have questions about the idea of this avian flu spreading to cows? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Keith Polson is director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory and clinical associate professor in the Medical Sciences Department at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Keith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Gave a couple of the very basics about this. Tell us a little bit more, please, about this avian flu being found, at least in some, cows.
You know, it's a pretty interesting finding, considering that this strain of avian influenza has been circulating in North and South America now since 2022. It's not very predictable about when we're going to see domestic poultry have issues. We saw in the spring of 2022 and then the fall of 2023. And we also have seen now nationwide about 130 different mammalian species and then some of our raptors like bald eagles and owls and hawks. But most of those mammalian species are carnivores, or what we call mesocarnivores, and they're scavengers. So when you think about bobcats out in the field, or even eagles when they're scavenging dead birds, and that's where we saw some mortality due to neurologic disease. So we saw brain infections. This example, and that's really what we saw in the goat kids in Minnesota. Oh gosh, that's probably 3 weeks ago now. And now this is a more of a novel presentation of this viral strain in ruminant species in our dairy cows. Now we've been seeing increased cow illness in Texas now since the beginning of February, but it took the industry and the diagnosticians around the country a few weeks to really recognize and rule out all of the common pathogens, mm-hmm. and then to really use some advanced technology to find that the current circulating strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza is associated with and potentially a component of why these cows are getting sick.
Now, this same virus affects different species differently, clearly pretty devastating in some cases for poultry here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. How does it seem to affect dairy cows so far? Obviously, an issue of great importance here in Wisconsin.
Right. And I think that's really why Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, we've been involved with this since the beginning, because a lot of our growing heifers or our young replacement females are raised in Texas and Kansas. And, you know, cows are very different. And here's what the really interesting component of this is that typically when we see disease or infections on a dairy farm, be it salmonellosis or let's say just a bovine viral diarrhea or something like that, it's usually in our younger animals, or then we see it in our high stress animals, which are right about the time that they're calving, because there's a lot going on when they're transitioning from a dry cow to a lactating cow. The cows in Texas and Kansas, and now we're expanding to Ohio, Michigan, and Idaho, and we could talk about that later, but these cows are typically, the cows that show clinical signs are those that are in their second lactation or more. So that means that they're usually 3 or 4 years or older, and they're usually 150 days in milk, meaning they calved at least 150 days ago. So they're coming off the peak of their lactation. They're getting into mid and late lactation. We're not seeing clinical signs in any young stock, any pregnant animals that are not lactating. No replacement heifers, no beef cows, no beef calves, no dry cows, and no transition cows or those cows that just had a calf, which is really interesting. It's a completely different way of thinking about or a different presentation of viral infections in dairy cows.
And then for those dairy cows at that stage, as it sounds like a very particular category at a very particular timing, when they've had this avian flu, when we've been able to detect it, do they recover? What's been the impact on them?
Yeah, and this is why, you know, most of the media and the coverage is really about this is high path influenza, avian influenza in cows. And it is the same strain, but we're not really seeing high pathogenicity. And, you know, here's the interesting part is that typically cows wear pedometers and they wear collars that measure how well their stomach motility, their rumen motility and feed intake is, just like, you know, wearing a Fitbit or an Oura ring or an Apple Watch. And that's usually the first thing that that happens with these cows is that those monitors and the computers will pull a cow to say, hey, she's not eating the same as she usually is, so you should take a look at her. Then the next thing that happens is as the cows go through the milking parlor, the parlor is actually measuring how much milk they have, and then they do a milk conductivity, so they actually run electricity through the milk sample. And as those cows, their feed drops, just like when anyone else is sick, you know, your feed intake kind of comes down or you're not really hungry. And then the cows don't make as much milk. So their milk conductivity score rises. And that's another way that the parlor will actually pull or sort a cow for further evaluation. And then when a veterinarian or a herd owner or employee goes in to look at their cows, we're seeing about 10% of that very kind of select population of cows, up to 10%, they'll have a fever. And they'll have a fever of anywhere from 103 to 105. There's some outliers that get a little warmer.
How bad is that for a cow? I'm going to stop you there. Yeah, that sounds bad for a human.
Yeah, great question. So a normal body temperature for a cow is 101.5.
Okay.
So really, yeah. So it's like having 100 to 101 fever for a person. So, and then they'll decrease in their milk, and they don't have mastitis or infection or inflammation in their udder. But their milk they do decrease in production, and the milk is a little bit thicker and it turns more yellow, similar to colostrum. So, and then to kind of get back to your question to beginning is that, you know, these cows recover. They have a very low mortality rate. We have not seen dead cows, which is very different than when we see this virus in domesticated poultry. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say it, you know, it's kind of a misnomer to say highly pathogenic avian influenza in the cows, because they do get sick, and it's, you know, and I don't want to downplay that because it really is hard on the cows, and that milk production decrease is really important for farmers. But the cows do recover. The cows that are later in lactation and later in their lactation curve, you know, they typically recover within 10 to 12 days. But those cows that are later in their lactation, they tend to not recover their milk production. So often those cows are sold to go into the meat food chain, mainly because the beef price is really high right now and milk price is at historic lows, and it has been very low for a long period of time. So there's a lot that goes into it.
We're talking to Keith Polson, director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, clinical associate professor in the medical sciences department at UW-Madison's School of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about cases of bird flu, the one you've heard of affecting poultry in the United States, being found in dairy cattle in parts of the U.S., and what we have to worry about, what kind of precautions, we'll look at that coming up, we can take. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? If you work in this industry, are you worried? Are you taking precautions? What kind of precautions do you usually take to make sure diseases don't spread to and among your livestock? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Keith Polson, director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, looking at avian flu. It's spread a lot and done a lot of damage in the poultry business. It's been found in dairy cattle. Seems less dangerous there. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Christina is with us in Glenwood. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. If a cow is being culled for slaughter due to avian flu, how safe is that meat for either humans or dog or cat food?
Good question, Christina. Keith, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's probably one of the most important talking points of this disease outbreak in our cows, is that pasteurized dairy products are absolutely safe. And the meat products that come from the cows are also safe if properly cooked. So that's really no different than any of our ongoing or current standards for food safety, is that we want to, you know, drink pasteurized dairy products, or use, you know, eat ice cream. That comes from a pasteurized dairy product as well. And then we cook our meat as what's on the label.
Thanks for the call. Christina, you specified pasteurized. There is a market for unpasteurized or so-called raw milk. I think the health advocacy folks worry about that in general. Is this another worry, this potential avian flu being spread by it somehow?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And while we don't have retail sale of raw milk in Wisconsin, we have a lot of incidental sale. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's a lot of demand for that. And we've worked with that over and over. And that, as a public health issue, I would not recommend drinking raw milk or feeding it to a family, especially those that live in urban areas. But really, in general, it's not a good idea for raw milk in general. This is just another reason why, is that cows, one of our best diagnostic tests for this novel outbreak or novel disease syndrome is we run PCR on our milk samples, and we know that cows are shedding virus in their milk that is very susceptible. Pasteurization is agreed by FDA, CDC, and USDA to be 100% effective to make that milk safe. And that's what's so important to our dairy industry. And drinking that unpasteurized, I think, would certainly not be recommended by our animal and public health officials.
Christina, thanks again for that call. Keith, as I mentioned, there's been one, I believe, confirmed case of a human exposed to cattle that are cows that have been infected with this virus, getting it, not super huge symptoms. It seems right now, at least, like that is a pretty major outlier. We're not seeing a lot of this.
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's actually the number two really important talking point, is that at this time, we do not see this as a significant public health threat. Now, influenza viruses change, they reassort, and that's probably why we're seeing this in cows now, is that we saw some genetic change in the virus. But we, you know, those, the one person that's been confirmed in Texas had direct contact with dairy cows that were affected. It wouldn't surprise me if there are others. We always typically have farm workers with high path, even on poultry farms, that might develop flu-like symptoms, but it's really rare for them to actually be confirmed with this strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza. And it really, there's some CDC and USDA have some really great personal protective equipment recommendations that really follow into the biosecurity guidelines of wearing safety glasses. Lots of dairy farm workers wear safety glasses anyway, safety glasses or maybe even a shield. We always wear gloves anyway, to really protect our cows so we're not transmitting bacteria or viruses from cow to cow. And then, you know, washing your hands. And really, that one case in Texas was a conjunctivitis. So as much as I don't want to downplay that, you know, they essentially had some inflammation in their eyes, because I'm sure that was uncomfortable, but it was really a low pathogenic finding.
Keith, what are you hoping for dairy farmers in Wisconsin when it comes to watching for and maybe reporting these kind of potential symptoms?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think in Wisconsin, we typically do not move lactating animals from different states to Wisconsin. We typically move springing heifers, which means, you know, pregnant heifers that will then calve and then enter the lactational string. We want to watch those cows, and really, if possible, we want to have them isolated or put into maybe a quarantine facility on the farm And we want to look for feed intake. We also want to look for fevers. And if you have any questions or you're seeing any type of abnormal health change, to contact your veterinarian. We've been putting out lots of information for all of our bovine veterinarians. It's a pretty small community in Wisconsin, and we're blessed with some of the best bovine veterinarians in the country. But call your vet. The Department of Animal Health is another great place to call. And then, of course, the university and the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is a great resource. You can check our website as well.
How do we do when it comes to biosecurity in dairy farms on Wisconsin, Keith? Because I could see an argument being like, hey, these cows are people's livelihood. They're going to be really careful. I could see this is a low margin industry. Maybe things fall by the wayside. Maybe that includes biosecurity in general. From what you see out there, how do we do on that?
I think dairy in general and across the country could always do better. I think we're far behind the swine and poultry industries because those two industries have really been forced to really tighten up their biosecurity because of things like highly pathogenic avian influenza. Our dairy cows, we really haven't seen something like this in the past. There's lots of information out there about how to tighten up biosecurity. Most of it was developed to maintain business continuity during a foot and mouth disease outbreak, which we haven't seen since the 1920s. But it's, you know, at securemilksupply.org and securebeef.org, we have lots of different plans to be able to tighten up security. And then through the American Association of Bovine Practitioners and the National Milk Producers Federation, we've linked to this on our website as well. And we have really kind of cleaned up the biosecurity guidelines from foot and mouth disease and made them very easy to understand. I would have any animal dairy producer go download those guidelines, contact your veterinarian. They probably aren't going to be able to do all of them, but every little bit helps. And I think that's something that we're always working with our dairy producers to tighten up biosecurity because it does have a good return on investment. And then it protects you or protects your herd and your farm and your livelihood and the community and the economy of the state by being prepared.
Keith, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. Please let me know if you have any questions.
That's Keith Polson, director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, clinical associate professor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, with us to break down news of confirmed cases of a bird flu found in some dairy cattle around the country, and at least, as we heard one person, what it means for agriculture and public health. Wisconsin has fewer coal-burning power plants today than in the past, and utilities are planning to retire more plants in the next few years. As Joe Schultz reports, those closures are part of a move to reduce carbon emissions. They could also create new opportunities for development at the former plant sites.
In 2021, the Dairyland Power Cooperative decommissioned its coal-burning power plant in Genoa. Last month, local officials and utility staff members watched from a nearby bluff as they used explosives to demolish it. A large smokestack crashes to the ground as smoke and dust rise from the remains. Leaders of the utility are still planning what's next for the site. Brent Ridge is the CEO of Dairyland.
We're going to be looking for economic development opportunities that could range from manufacturing all the way to another power-generating resource.
The Genoa plant isn't unique. The state had 13 large-scale coal plants in 2005. It had 7 as of 2020. That's according to the State Public Service Commission. 3 more are expected to come offline by 2026. Scientists say burning coal to generate electricity is a big contributor to climate change. Utilities say they're committed to reducing carbon emissions, but their goals are voluntary. They aren't mandated by state law. In 2022, both We Energies and Alliant pushed back plant retirements, citing supply chain issues for solar components. Environmental groups say it's imperative that utilities move away from coal as quickly as possible to mitigate the worst effects of climate change. Utilities have pledged to go carbon neutral by 2050.
If it wasn't important to our customers, it wouldn't be important to us. So we're not going fast enough for some of them. Some of them, we're going probably too fast.
That's J.P. Brummond, an executive with Alliant Energy. The utility plans to take its Edgewater generating station in Sheboygan County offline next year. The site sits along Lake Michigan. Trains coming into its rail yard carry coal that will be burned to generate electricity. Inside, industrial piping lines many of the walls and ceilings. Operations manager Terry Dumez points to a diagram outlining the plant's layout and process for converting coal to electricity.
It's pulverized coal. It comes out basically like powder after it goes through the pulverizer. It just gets blown, transported with air.
The utility has had early discussions with local officials and hired a consultant to help come up with a plan for the site's future. Meanwhile, a former coal plant in southeast Wisconsin is expected to see new life in the coming years. We Energies tore down its plant in Pleasant Prairie in 2022. Last month, it sold the site to Nevada-based developer Dermody Properties. Dermody plans to convert the site into a three-building industrial campus. Neil Driscoll is with the developer. He says the site's infrastructure factored into those plans.
It gives us really good opportunities to tap into the power that's in the area, which is a big factor and, quite frankly, is a growing one with everyone's interest in data centers.
A former Alliant Energy plant in Beloit has had a second life since it came offline in the 2010s. While the site once sounded like this, it now sounds like this. When the Blackhawk Generating Station closed, Beloit College saw opportunity in the century-old building. The college struck a deal in 2014, allowing it to convert the site into a fitness and student center. The center opened in 2020. It still features coal hoppers, a control panel, and industrial piping. Beloit College even saved the plant's smokestack, though it no longer produces billowing clouds. Dan Schoof is with the college. He says there's something symbolic about the project.
It was polluting for a purpose to generate power, but it did a lot of damage in the community, as all coal plants did. And so for us now to take that and be a place of learning, that's a different kind of energy.
Despite the closure of coal plants, environmental groups are critical of some utilities' plans to replace them with natural gas plants. They say more work is needed to get to zero carbon emissions. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about that story and see all the latest from our news and talk teams over at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, Governor Tony Evers signed a new bipartisan bill aimed at bolstering flood prevention in Wisconsin. It's called the Pre-Disaster Flood Resilience Grant Program. It invests in restoring and protecting wetlands, which make communities more flood resilient. This comes after historic flooding throughout the state last spring that led Governor Evers to declare a state of emergency. According to our next guest, the United States is in a flooding crisis, with floods occurring with greater frequency and intensity. In his new book, he says it will require creative solutions working with nature instead of against it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with flooding in your community lately? Were you affected by major floods in the past? Have you moved because of concerns about flooding? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tim Palmer is a writer, photographer, former land use planner, and river conservation advocate. He's the author of more than 30 books about the environment, most recently, Seek Higher Ground, the natural solution to our urgent flooding crisis. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, I'm thrilled to be here.
Before we dig into the book, Tim, I wonder if you could talk some about wetlands. I mentioned that newly passed law here in Wisconsin aimed at boosting them. Is that an important part of flood prevention and mitigation?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, wetlands are the sponges of the earth. You know, they soak up flood waters and delay their release into the rivers and ultimately the ocean. So protecting wetlands is super important to do. And the more that we can do, the less flood damage we will have.
In Seek Higher Ground, you give kind of your origin story of your interest in floods and rivers because you're a survivor of a flood, the Hurricane Agnes flood of 1972. Can you tell us what you saw there that inspired you to take this on as an issue for the next 40 plus years?
Yeah. Well, I was living in a small Appalachian village at the time. but a tributary to the West Branch of the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania. And, you know, all it did was rain for 3 days, but this was the center of the Hurricane Agnes storm, which had moved up the West Coast, and then it had drifted offshore, picking up more water over the Atlantic, but suddenly turned inland again and hovered over Pennsylvania for 3 days. At the time, it was the most damaging flood in American history. I happened to be there, ground zero of the storm. The water came up and up and up. It almost flooded my house, not quite, but it was close, and I ended up helping neighbors and, you know, helping my town. And as soon as I could get out, which I couldn't do for like 3 or 4 days because bridges were out, landslides were down, the water was raging. As soon as I could get out, I went back to my job, which was working as the environmental planner for Lycoming County, Pennsylvania. And there, my task was not only to figure out how we could recover from this flood, but more importantly, how we could avoid this kind of catastrophic loss in the future. And that ultimately led me on the road that that ended up with this book, Seek Higher Ground.
One big point you make in the book, Tim, is that we often live in a state of denial over flooding. We see flooding again and again, maybe in the same place over the years, over the decades, into geological time and beyond. But our attention spans get pretty short, even after the last big one comes along.
Yeah, it's kind of a one-word description of the most common response to this problem, you know, denial. Right after the floods, you know, many people are motivated to do something different, but that typically fades in a few months or years at most. Whereas this problem is here to stay, and it's getting worse. And what we've done in the past is not adequate. I mean, at best, you would say it's inadequate. At worst, much of what we have done is misdirected. We relied way too heavily on building dams in an effort to stop floods from occurring, which we've not been able to do, and building levees in an effort to keep the floods away from our homes and businesses. And unfortunately, you know, dams and levees tend to work for small and medium floods, but not the really big ones, like in the Mississippi in 1993 and many other years. 93 was the great flood of American history, and 1,000 of 1,500 levees, major levees on the Mississippi Basin, failed in that flood. So those were not adequate approaches. Paying relief to people after the floods occur is not adequate. What we really need to do is try to eliminate this problem altogether. And we can do that if we stop new development on open space of floodplains that remains, and if we help people to relocate wherever they're willing to go.
I want to dig into those points in a bit, but actually you write that building lots of dams and levees gives people the confidence to build and develop and live in those floodplains, believing that they're safe, and they may be from those lesser floods. In a way, building those dams and levees has made us more vulnerable to flooding.
Yeah, it's kind of a vicious cycle downward. You know, we have flood damage, so the Army Corps has built dams, and people believe they're safe below them, so they build even more. But then the dams are inadequate, so we build more dams or more levees, you know, and more people move in. And ultimately, you might have imagined that this approach could have worked in the past. But now, and this is the reason I wrote the book when I did, now because of global heating, the floods are getting worse. So that approach has not worked in the past, and it's going to work even less in the future because we face floods that are more intense, more frequent, and more widespread in the years to come.
Tim Palmer is with us. We're talking about his new book. It's called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tim, working toward a solution, you write, requires us in some ways to embrace what might feel like a really weird mindset, the idea that flooding is A, natural, and B, beneficial. In some ways, it's been a key part of allowing life on much of Earth. Could you talk about that mindset a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. There's a whole different side to this flooding coin. what we hear about so much is destruction and mayhem and loss. But in fact, floods are a natural part of what the Earth does. They are part of the hydrologic cycle, which goes back to the beginning of time. We all know it. The water evaporates over the ocean. The wind carries it over land. It rains and the water flows back to sea, sometimes in very great amounts. This has happened forever. And so all the natural systems of the Earth have adapted to that. And in fact, not only do they tolerate floods, but they benefit from floods. Floods aren't only inevitable, they are beneficial in the natural world, and in our world, if we could just stay out of the way of floods. For example, fish need floods. Fish need high water because that's what shapes the river channels in beneficial ways to them, creating both riffles and deep holes that are needed for cold water that's retained there. Floods are what wash sand out to our ocean beaches and form those beaches on our seacoasts. So if you like the beach, you got to like floods. If you like fish, you got to like floods. Floods are what soak into the groundwater, replenishing it. And half of our public water supplies depend on groundwater. So if you want to get water out of that tap when you turn the faucet, you got to like floods. They're critical to the way the natural world works. And what we do can be very compatible with that if we just recognized and respected this natural system that we have.
That's not the way we've developed a lot over the years. We've built lots of housing and farmland, and the list goes on in floodplains, where it's right there in the name, floods sometimes happen. How do you turn that trend around?
Yeah. Well, there are good ways to do that. Let me mention just a couple numbers that support that. Mm-hmm. 90% of our floodplain land is not heavily developed. It's farmland, it's wildland, it's forest, it's open space, or lightly settled land, 90%. So if we protect that land, the problem, we will prevent the problem from getting way, way worse than it already is. And another number, 7% of the land actually is floodplain. That leaves 93% that is not flood prone. And that includes a lot of other places to build. Certainly not all of that is suitable for building, but a lot of it is. And a lot of it is way more suitable than the floodplain land, you know, where we're at risk of loss and even hazards to life. So there are opportunities to go elsewhere. There is an opportunity to protect open space that remains. We need to do that through effective local zoning to protect the open space areas. Wisconsin has actually been a leader in this. And we need to support public programs of helping people to relocate off of the floodplain wherever they are willing to go. And again, Wisconsin has been a leader in that. Years ago in the 1970s and 80s, Wisconsin started a statewide floodplain management program. They hired a very talented young hydrologist, Larry Larson, to run the program. Larry put together a great program and ultimately became the head of a group called the Association of State Floodplain Managers. It went from just a few people in the beginning to 20 chapters and 20,000 members across the United States. And these are the people in the state and local agencies that work toward better management of our floodplains. And much of that legacy of protection goes back to history in Wisconsin.
Tim Palmer is with us, writer, photographer, river conservation advocate. His new book is called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you lived through a flood in your community? Did you relocate to higher ground in maybe Soldiers Grove, or some people moved and some government buildings moved in Gays Mills? Were you there for the Lake Delton dam burst or the 2018 floods across northern Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Tim Palmer about his new book, Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a flood-prone area? Have you considered moving because of it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jay is with us in Washburn. Jay, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. And Tim, I really appreciate the subject and the discussion. I guess I'll say as a fishery biologist who has studied riverine habitat for decades, I really appreciate your discussion on the fact that floods are essential for habitat. A lot of people think that floods are this extreme, really negative event, but they actually do a lot of good that people might not see. And then one thing I wanted to bring up, and I don't know if you cover this in your book or not, but the idea of flood frequency is something that I think people don't have a real strong understanding of. And up here in Washburn, we've had, I think, at least a couple of 500-year events in the last decade. And when people hear something about a 100-year flood, they think, well, you know, we're not going to have another one of these for 100 years. But then we have one 5 years later, and they think that the forecasts are wrong and that the forecasters don't know what they're talking about. But in fact, what's going on is there's a 1 in 100 chance of having that event in any given year. It's not a 100-year flood. It's a 1 in 100 chance, and I think people really need to understand that better.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, that's a big concern, I think, for us in the media, Tim, is how we interpret phrases like the 1,000-year flood, 500-year flood, and so on.
Yeah, may I comment on that, Rob?
Definitely, please do.
Yeah, Jay, you nailed it. I mean, it is a 100-year flood is a 1% chance of flooding in any given year. Could happen this year, could happen next year. However, in the really long term, we should not be seeing 100-year floods happening, you know, 2 and 3 years in a row, or even once or twice every two decades. And so much of the mapping that has been done has not taken into account enough data. When you think about it, a lot of these floodplain maps have been based on 50 years of data, or 100 is a whole lot, whereas the cycles of nature are much, much longer than that. And so we have not a whole lot of data to begin with. And now the flood frequency and intensity is increasing with global warming. And so the flood maps that were done, say, up until this point in time, really are no longer as accurate as they need to be because the floods are getting worse. And so these and other reasons mean that we need to have better floodplain mapping that more effectively relates to the kind of schedule flooding that we can expect in the future.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. We heard from Ed in Northern Illinois who wanted to hear about the Great Flood of 1927, which he says killed thousands, affected millions of acres, and should scare the heck out of people. This is something you do talk about in the book, Tim. Remind us about the flood of 1927.
Yeah. This was especially severe on the lower Mississippi, you know, in the South. And it was the biggest flood up to that time. The 93 flood has eclipsed that since then, you know, not that long ago. But one of the really significant things about 1927 was up until then, Americans pretty much across the board regarded flooding as a local issue. You know, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania flooded 18 times up till then. And yet the city was unable to get federal engagement in helping them deal with flood control. Now, you know, for better or worse, this idea of local responsibility was broadened by the 27 flood, where even Southern politicians who typically had a very anti-federal attitude and to this day do not want the federal government involved in almost anything they do except where federal benefits might be involved, even Southern politicians supported the national government becoming engaged in flood issues. And that led directly to the Flood Control Act of 1936, which also hammered the Upper Ohio Basin. So we then had this coalition of Northern and Southern interests to move Congress to act. And that law started the Army Corps of Engineers on building flood control dams. the approach still was not the right approach. You know, now we're launching a massive federal program to build dams wherever they possibly could be built. The Army Corps built 400 of these. We spent billions of dollars. The flood damage continued to get worse and worse and worse because we did not match that construction effort with the ideas I talk about in my book, which are protecting open space so the floods don't get, flood damage doesn't get worse, and helping people relocate to just get away from the problem and be done with it.
Tim Palmer is with us. We're talking about his new book, Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. People might hear that idea of relocating and think, I don't want to leave my town, my house to move somewhere else. How do you overcome opposition to this idea of relocation as a flood solution?
Yeah, well, first of all, Rob, I don't know of any floodplain management programs today that require people to move. They are all, to my knowledge, oriented toward helping people move when they want to go. And it turns out a lot of people want to go. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, every year gets far more requests for funding assistance to help people who want to move off of the floodplain into safer terrain than they are able to pay for. So no one's making people move. A lot of people do want to move. And typically, you know, after you're flooded two or three or four, or let's say five or 10 times, people want to go. You know, they recognize that this is futile. They keep rebuilding and they keep, you know, encountering these problems over and over. Here are two amazing numbers. Let me just, yeah, my book is full of data, but let me just mention two numbers here. The Natural Resources Defense Council cranked thousands of data points on this, on the issue of federal spending for flooding. And they found that for every $1.70 that the federal government spends helping people move and get away from the flood problem, we, the federal taxpayers, spend $100 helping people to stay and endure the next flood. And we do that through funding assistance to quote, flood-proof their houses, even though there really isn't any such thing. We pay enormous subsidies for federally backed flood insurance, a program that now has a $24 billion deficit, and other programs of federal assistance that go in an extremely lopsided manner toward helping people stay and be flooded again rather than to move and solve the problem. So that ratio of federal spending, in my way of thinking, needs to be reversed so that we give more attention to helping people get away from the problem and not have it anymore.
And just our last, less than a minute now, Tim, you also share a vision for what land on floodplains could look like, greenways that we still can use and appreciate.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, greenways are one of the most popular public initiatives nationwide. Everybody loves parks along rivers with trail systems and with access for boating and fishing and swimming and hiking or just sitting and watching the river flow if you want to do that. And when we reclaim these areas that have been developed on floodplains and convert them into municipal parks, that's what people get. And these programs are extremely popular. You know, I visited a number of them in the book, like in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Nashville, Tennessee, and Wycoming County, Pennsylvania. And, you know, when we can make this transition to protecting open space that remains and converting developed areas, usually lightly developed areas, into parkland, we end up creating these wonderful community assets that everybody loves.
We'll leave it there. Tim, thanks again for joining us today.
Great to be with you. I hope you people enjoy the book.
That's Tim Palmer, writer, photographer, former land use planner, and river conservation advocate. He's written more than 30 books on environmental issues. He's with us for a look at his latest book. It's called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. If you have a story about how you or your community reacted after a flood, did you see improvements made, people moving away from those most flood-prone areas, for example, let us know about it. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, how big a role can biofuels like ethanol and others play in our overall energy mix? Kate and her guests dig into the latest research on potentially sustainable biofuels, and you could join in with your thoughts and your questions. Get started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org, then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Last night, I was lucky enough to see Herbie Hancock in concert. Legendary musician, composer, keyboard pioneer who's played jazz, funk, fusion, electronic, and more. I mention it now because he was a guest on this show some years back. Now, here's the thing. I've interviewed a lot of people over the years. We don't do a lot of, like, celebrity stuff, but I've talked to some well-known people, right? And mostly, I do just fine. It's just another interview. But as I was getting ready to record an interview with Herbie Hancock, I got kind of overwhelmed. Because as a kid, I listened to his music a lot, some of his jazz, a lot of the electronic stuff, and I just had this moment like, I'm about to say words to actual Herbie Hancock, and then Herbie Hancock is going to say words to me, and I didn't know if I was going to keep it together. Fortunately, we had a little technical problem. That gave me a minute to pull myself together, and everything went fine. And so did the show last night. Hey, this was the encore. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Sports betting is now legal in 38 states. Here in Wisconsin, it's limited to on-site live gambling at certain casinos. In many other states, online sports bets are fully legal. Sports gambling companies like DraftKings and FanDuel have formed partnerships with professional sports leagues themselves to promote betting on their platforms. But as sports gambling has become more prominent, so have the sports betting scandals. Major League Baseball was shocked last month when reigning MVP Shohei Ohtani was connected to an illegal sports gambling enterprise through his longtime personal translator. The NBA is currently investigating betting irregularities involving Toronto Raptors backup Jontae Porter. In recent years, we've seen multiple NFL players and college athletes suspended for gambling, and a college baseball coach at Alabama was fired for leaking inside information to a gambler. It's not just limited to the U.S. The top professional soccer league in Italy is dealing with gambling violations that have spread over into other international leagues. The world of professional tennis has dealt with multiple issues of match-fixing operations. It's raising questions about the impact gambling could have on the actual competition and integrity of sporting events. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been keeping up with any of these sports betting scandals? Are you surprised to see them popping up? Do you gamble on sports? If you're willing to share that story, if you are in a place where it's legal, do you do online sports bets? There are lots of options out there. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Myrer is an assistant professor of communications at UW-Milwaukee, where he studies sports media and journalism. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, reading that long list of recent sports scandals, there's a lot going on. Are you surprised or did you feel like this was coming with the explosion in legal sports gambling?
So I think it's interesting just to think about these scandals. You know, they all sort of fall under the rubric of gambling scandal. But, I, you know, in some ways, they're both sort of two different versions of this. Right. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, assuming that the version of the Shohei Ohtani story is correct, that it was really just a person connected to him that was making some bad choices. I mean, that speaks to anyone who's ever lived around someone with addiction, right? That gambling is another addiction that potentially all of this is exacerbating. The case with Jontae Porter is more serious. You know, that goes directly to the integrity of the game. And I really wonder, you know, basketball is perhaps the most susceptible to that type of gambling. And while Jontae Porter, you know, is not a serious and important player, he can, of course, undermine the entire integrity of the sporting enterprise.
I want to talk about that story in particular. The short version is there were bets not about who wins and loses a game. There are these so-called prop bets where you can bet on a zillion different things, including whether player X scores more or fewer than a certain number of points, makes a certain number of rebounds, things like that. In that case, the accusation is that he claimed an injury early in the game, that and there were an unusual number of bets for him not to do very much in a game, and that paid off big for some people. There are lots of very micro ways to gamble on games, and it opens the door to maybe having somebody not throw a whole game, but just behave a little differently during the game so that people win bets.
Right. So viewers or listeners might have heard the term point shaving, mm-hmm. right? And that comes from the idea that, you know, oftentimes you don't have to lose a whole game to swing a bet, right? A late basket can change a game from one team. If you bet on a point spread, right? You bet on a team to win or lose by a certain number of points. So sometimes when the game is decided and some person just launches a shot from the half court line with no time left as the buzzer goes and it goes in, that can swing bets one way or the other. The Jontay Porter thing is interesting because how would people know that this person was not going to be playing, right? And that's where the NBA policy comes in. And the NBA policy tells players no betting and no tipping. You're not supposed to give any inside information. But if people knew that he wasn't really going to play, if they're getting that information from his camp, that's a real undermining of the competitive enterprise. And that's a thing that the sports leagues really can't afford to deal with. That's really potentially damaging for them.
We're talking to Michael Myrer from UW-Milwaukee about sports gambling. It's much more legal in most of the United States than it used to be. There are concerns about how it might affect the game, players gambling, maybe players and coaches doing things to help some people win their bets. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Want to look at another story. You mentioned the Shohei Ohtani, a Major League Baseball MVP. We have this strange case. His translator supposedly, according to one account, stole Shohei Ohtani's money to pay off a bookie. There are questions, how directly was the player himself involved? Here's what Ohtani said about this, speaking through a different translator.
So I never bet on baseball or any other sports, or never have asked somebody to do it on my behalf. And I have never went through a bookmaker to bet on sports. Up until a couple of days ago, I didn't know that this was happening. Just to kind of just go over the result, in conclusion, Ipe has been stealing money from my account and has told lies.
Now, there's some degree of separation, according to that account, from the player and the betting. This is a big-name player, though. How big a concern is this for Major League Baseball, Michael?
I mean, if Shohei Ohtani turns out to have been involved with this, you know, the precedent for Major League Baseball is lifetime suspensions and lifetime bans, right? Pete Rose still isn't still in the Hall of Fame. He's the all-time hits leader, but because of his gambling, he's still not in the Hall of Fame. So there's a lot riding on the outcome of that sort of investigation, and a lot of, you don't want to prejudge and you don't want to sort of speak to people's worst instincts, but of course, there's a lot riding on baseball not finding anything that Shohei Ohtani did anything wrong. And there's no indication that he did, right? It's just hard to tell. But baseball's precedent is lifetime bans for gambling on baseball. And so, you know, I sort of understand why he's saying he's not involved. You know, if it's true, you know, that would make sense. And if it's not true, of course, he would still deny it because there isn't any real gray area in baseball's rules. And the challenge for him would be, you know, maintaining his career that way. Should it be found that he was involved in some way?
Different sporting organizations at different levels have different rules, but there might be anything from don't bet on sports at all, period, to it's a legal activity. You could bet if you're a baseball player, you could bet on a football game, but you can't bet on baseball. And the big red line is gambling on games that you, in fact, yourself are playing in. Can you talk about the different degrees of red flags that we're talking about, that we're playing with here?
Sure. So, you know, I would say that within professional sports, there is like a culture of gambling. You know, people on team planes, there are ongoing poker games and card games. And they have tournament pools the same way that most of us have tournament pools, and they play fantasy sports together. These are competitive people, and they like to compete. They'll be shooting contests for money after practice at teams. And that's always been kind of part of the fabric of sports. For leagues where you can bet on other leagues, but not yourself, right? That would make the most sense in that, you know, as long as it's not people who you are connected to, as long as it's not your sport, you would expect that would be potentially better. Although, you know, athletes tend to know each other, right? Not everybody's friends with everybody, but people do know each other, and you do wonder if inside information can travel that way. I think it's really dangerous for athletes to get involved with gambling in any way, right? I think it's something that in terms of working with bookies and betting on sports, you know, if somebody was asking me, I would say there's only downside for that, because ultimately you never know when you're going to get caught up in something that way. It make, you know, and obviously betting, you know, Pete Rose, his suspension came because he was betting on his team. And then, of course, you know, he would say he only bet on his team to win. But if he didn't bet every day, you know, was he signaling to bookies to bet on his team to lose if he wasn't going to put money on his team every day? Right. Because that was an indirect signal that maybe he didn't have any faith in that night's starting pitcher, for instance.
We're talking to UW-Milwaukee sports media professor Michael Myrer about sports betting and recent gambling scandals of various sorts that have emerged in lots and lots of major sports. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you participate in sports betting? Have you in the past? What's that experience like? Have you checked out some of the many online platforms that are not legal to play on here in Wisconsin, but in many states they are? Do you worry about big money in sports betting affecting athletes, affecting the game? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Michael Myrer, sports media professor at UW-Milwaukee, with us today to talk about the growth of sports gambling as recent betting-related scandals have hit lots of major sports lately. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think sports leagues should handle betting at the pro level, the college level? Wisconsin hasn't legalized online gambling. All those websites you see advertised during the sports game, can't do it here. Should we be able to? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I guess my question is, you know, how do you explain to young people who might try their best to do the best they can to participate in sports in some way that maybe you don't have to try your best? You just have to do good enough, and then you can get in the game and shave a few points and make your money. Doesn't this just send the entire wrong message? I don't see any green shoots for the public in this.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Concerns about, how this affects those young athletes and their view of the game, Michael.
Yeah, I think sports organizations spend a lot of time talking about the pro-social value of sports, right? And I think a lot of us believe, and a lot of us who are listening have probably had good experiences or important formative experiences, maybe not totally good, playing sports as kids or seeing that with kids in our lives. And I think it really is a challenging question for sporting organizations, whether this is a good idea to be associating themselves with something, you know, as potentially problematic as gambling, right? There's certainly scandal. We're seeing these scandals in the game. We're seeing scandals outside of the games. But there was like I saw a story about a PTA in Maryland where they were fundraising for the first school, but the treasurer stole the money and put it on prop bets, the things that we're talking about. Like, it's, you're taking your brand, which is this positive thing. Sports is supposed to be a positive thing, a positive social force, and you're associating it with gambling, which, you know, is not always a positive force in our society. Some would say it's never a positive force in our society. I think this is going to be a problem for sports leagues to have to grapple with. I think you've seen this in England, where they've started to cut back a little bit on some of the sports gambling tie-ins within the Premier League when they've had some high-profile scandals. And that's something that American sports leagues are going to have to grapple with. And I think it's a danger for the sports industry to associate themselves so closely with gambling.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We've focused mainly on pro sports so far. I want to turn now to amateur athletics and the NCAA. NCAA President Charlie Baker has, in different forums over the last few months, called for an end to prop bets. These, will this player do this or the team do this, not just win and loss bets. He wants to see bans in states on prop bets in college sports. Here's a listen.
The message I kept getting from them was there's so much of this going on. It's very hard for us to just stay away from it and out of it. And what they meant by that was being dragged into it by their classmates who wanted to talk to them about how so-and-so doing. Is he or she going to be able to play this weekend? What do you think your chances are? I mean, it was the exact same conversations that I was having with my classmates and schoolmates in the 70s. But back then, it was just chatter in the cafeteria or the dining hall. Now it's currency.
Can you talk about what we're seeing at the college level, that pressure being put on athletes, even if they don't want to gamble, the idea that that casual conversation with a classmate might be milking them for information for the next prop bet?
100%. Information is a currency in gambling, right? If the people who knew that Jonte Porter might not play very well, like they had an inside scoop. College sports do not have uniform information injury reporting policies. They doesn't have the same level of transparency that's required at the professional level, which means there's a lot more inside information bouncing around in college sports. I think the prop bets are especially a danger there, just because you have the lack of uniform transparency. You also don't have players being paid very much. Mm-hmm. Players are not making their money from schools. They might be making money through name, image, and likeness deals, which also was just recently legalized. But sharing information, that is going to be a greater temptation, I think, at the college level, just because there's not the same level of money that they would be risking to lose on that.
Another angle at colleges, we had the Iowa and Iowa State football teams, I believe. Players had violated rules on betting on sports. They weren't supposed to. A lot of them got suspended for games, a risk of losing scholarships, things like that. What do you think the NCAA and colleges themselves should be doing when it comes to setting and enforcing standards on whether the athletes can place bets themselves?
I think the idea that athletes gambling legally or illegally opens them up to a lot of potential problems. And so I would encourage them not to do it. You know, the NCAA as an enforcement arm really isn't, NCAA as an enforcement arm really was only going to follow what they find from law enforcement or newspaper reporting and that sort of stuff. So I really think that that college sports and gambling, college sports as we have them and gambling, are a pretty combustible mix. And I think that's a place where, near total bans are probably the right call and also really difficult to enforce.
Now, Michael, we know I'm not naive. Sports gambling has been around for a long time, a little bit of it legal, a lot of it illegal. Scandals have been around. It's been over 100 years since the 1919 World Series, so-called Black Sox scandal. That said, with the explosion in legal online gambling, as you mentioned, partnerships with these websites and leagues, things like that, is something different now? Is there more money coming into it, more people with a stake in it that's going to maybe raise the risk of future scandals?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you legalize something, you make it more available, right? So when gambling was illegal, you had to know a bookie, right? You had to know how to operate a VPN so you could bet offshore, right? You had to know how to do these things. Now it's just more available. I can just doubt, not in Wisconsin, right? But mm-hmm. when I go visit my sister in Detroit, I can go download an app on my phone and gamble there if I'm so inclined. it's just going to make it just makes it more present in our lives. It's been absent forever. It's been the big year of sports, so we've always had those concerns. But now, so the sports leagues are telling us to do it, right? They're saying, "Hey, here's our partner. Bet with them." That's new, right? That's a new feeling, and I think just making it more accessible is going to increase the number of people who get addicted to it, who bet the rent money, who are wagering more money than they have, more money they can afford to lose. And I think that just that accessibility, again, it sort of open it, it brings this potential negative force into people's lives. You know, with gambling, it's sort of the case where the dose makes the poison, right? That most of us can just place a bet and not, it's one bet and we go on to the next thing. But for some people, it's going to become a habit and an addiction and a compulsion and a thing that's really going to affect their lives negatively. And sports leagues choosing to associate themselves with that, you know, I think are taking a long-term reputational risk.
Assuming that we don't like the idea of gambling corrupting our sports in one way or another, who do you look to take the lead on trying to fix things? I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed this online sports gambling, allowed states to legalize it. That cat's out of the bag. Who do you think needs to take charge and take action now?
I think so long as, you know, ideally leagues would be able to regulate it properly, right? And so we'll see. So the NFL has suspended people, right? So when they're catching gambling violations, they are acting. You know, the NBA has Jonte Porter out. So hopefully, right, leagues can keep this contained internally when it comes to players. When it comes to what's happening with people out in the public who are listening to the advertisements they're getting in game broadcasts and then choosing to place these bets, you know, that this is going to be a case where, you know, there's not a good regulator out there. You know, the states are conflicted because they're getting tax money from these bets. The leagues are conflicted because they are getting massive sponsorship deals with a lot of these gambling companies. It's going to really come down to law enforcement, you know, ensuring that the rules are followed. But there's nothing, you know, the whole point of this is that you lose money sometimes. So it's hard to sort of see where there's any protection for it's hard to see where there's any protection for consumers and for fans who choose to gamble.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That's Michael Myrer, assistant professor of communications at UW-Milwaukee, where he studies sports media and journalism. He was with us today to talk about recent sports betting-related scandals across professional and college sports. As sports gambling becomes more and more normalized, online sports gambling legal in many states. Wisconsin not on that list, at least not yet. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe what you've seen amongst your friends, your coworkers when it comes to sports gambling. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's been a lot of concern in recent years about honeybee populations in the United States and their huge role in pollinating crops. There may be some good news in a new federal report. We'll check out the state of the bees. And on Food Friday, the author of the cookbook Cool Pasta brings us a wide variety of delicious pasta salads. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.